This is an ABC podcast.
G'day, it's Clint Jasper with you. It's lovely to have your company as we head out for a trip around a big country. This week, we're dropping in on a family reunion as descendants of Italian migrants who made a new life in Australia's northern cane fields after the First World War get together to remember and celebrate their ancestors. We'll sit down for an old-fashioned cuppa with an expert on tea cozies. And we'll meet a teenager who's spending her gap year travelling Australia on horseback. She's aiming to cover more than 5,000 kilometres from north to south through some isolated and rugged landscapes.
It's definitely not easy. It can be very mentally challenging as well as physically. There's long periods of time where you may not see people. It's definitely a good adventure, and you appreciate it when you get somewhere. You know, you see a house and you get really excited, or a person. It definitely makes you appreciate everyday things.
Taking on an epic challenge, we'll meet that ambitious and adventurous teenager who's just started her journey on the Bicentennial Trail. That goes from Cooktown in far north Queensland all the way down to Healesville in Victoria, and that story is coming up. First today, it's taken 2 decades, $2.5 million, and the commitment of dozens of people. But an environmental project to rehabilitate riverbanks and stop sediment flowing into the sea is showing great promise, as Jennifer Nichols reports.
What we've got here, we've got some ribbon plant, which is what the lungfish spawn in. And after the 2013 floods, they all got washed out, so the lungfish didn't have any habitat to spawn in. So to see Vallisneria still here means that maybe we've slowed the system down enough that it can hang in, you know, whereas 2013, it took 3 years for that to come back. So that's an interesting and really good sign.
For Brad Wedlock, the presence of this ribbon plant, or Vallisneria, in this section of the Mary River in southeast Queensland is a very welcome sight. It's proof that the work he's been overseeing to control erosion is having an impact.
20 years ago, this site here looked terrible. There's no two ways about it. It was a terrible, terrible site. Not a lot of habitat for the aquatic species at all, like the Mary River cod. Thousands of cubic metres of soil were being lost every event. A huge amount of fine sediment would have made itself out onto the Great Barrier Reef. Today, this is immensely different. The habitat values are here, the banks are a lot more stable, the site is progressing, we're getting recovery happening, whereas before it was still degrading 20 years ago when I used to come down here and shake my head and think, what can we actually do here? And the public are using it, you know, the public are coming here and watching what's happening.
Hello, I'm Jennifer Nichols. I've met Brad, a project officer with the Mary River Catchment Coordinating Committee, on the banks of the river at Kenilworth in the Sunshine Coast hinterland. It's been a huge effort to transform the river from those degraded banks Brad despaired over 20 years ago to a much healthier system today. It's been achieved through a range of measures, including planting more than 40,000 native seedlings and stabilising the banks of the river with timber piles.
So these timber piles, they're called, pile fields, they were put in 2015 after Cyclone Marcia. What the intent of them is just to slow the flow down close to what we call the toe of the riverbank, so that's the critical bit for stabilising, is keeping this toe nice and stable. And they're like, they're simulating trees.
So there's rows of them. There's a row at the front and then there's three rows stretching up into the bank.
Yeah, and so that's just to slow that flow down very close to the edge of the riverbank on this flat. And then in time, there's rainforest trees suited to the Mary River are planted in here to then build long-term structure that these timber piles will eventually, they'll rot away and disappear, but in time those rainforest trees will then simulate what we've got here already. So it's just trying to slow the whole flow of the river down.
Now, after those huge floods that we had, the biggest we've had in quite a while, you came back, it was still here.
Yeah, that's right. We had a 9.5 metre flood here at Kenilworth. It was third highest on record. And we didn't know what we were going to find. And when we got here, we were overjoyed. We saw everything was intact. All the plantings were intact here. The site functioned as we thought it should have functioned. Trees have been knocked around by debris coming down and knocking them around, but they'll come back. They're not ripped out of the ground. The piles are still here. The piles have built up debris and silt, which is exactly what we wanted it to do. so that there eventually will be sort of just overwhelmed by the silt and the sand. And so then the grasses will come in, capture that, and then the trees will also come in. So yeah, we were really happy with what's happened here in this whole Kenilworth Reach. It's a real good success story for these floods.
How many projects similar to this with these pile fields do you have along the Mary River now?
Yeah, so most of the work's concentrated here in Kenilworth. There's seven here now. There's another site downstream closer into the Mary Valley, close to Gympie. It was put in late last year. And we've got another four of those planned for this year further downstream, so north of Gympie, on the Mary River around Tyro and Miver. There's about 20 landholders that we've been working with over the last 20 years from the bridge up to about Walleye Creek. Collectively, that's what's been the success, is that basically every property on this reach here has had some sort of remediation work happen.
I've just come downstream to Stephen and Ruth Carter's property, where I visited in November 2019, and it is a really stark difference. The rows of piles are still here, but the bank is completely vegetated and it's just looking amazing. You pair must be very happy.
Extremely happy. We could never have foreseen this, but it's amazing difference, because otherwise this land wouldn't be here. It'd be further downstream and washed out.
There used to be a 10 metre drop off. How steep was the bank?
Yes, it was 10 metres, and each flood, beautiful soil just kept falling into the river. Over the time, we've lost a good 10 acres in, you know, 40-odd years. So this has certainly protected it beyond any dreams that we ever had, yes.
Well, this is called Mount Ubi Station. It was originally 3,500 acres. It's now down to about 90. The river has changed an awful lot. We've got aerial photos going back to just after the war, and the river used to go way over the other side towards Kenilworth, and now it's come back this way. But that's the nature of rivers.
How much hope do you think this gives other landholders down the reach of the Mary River and the environment as well?
Oh, we strongly encourage people, if they're given the opportunity, to partake in this project. It's been a wonderful success, and we're overwhelmed with the support we've received from all the stakeholders. They've all collaborated so well. It's a huge credit to them all.
Oh, buongiorno.
It's so good to see you.
Oh, Pauline.
It's special.
Thank you so much for organising.
Here comes Philomena.
Oh, look at that.
As you can hear, it's a joyous occasion as three generations of the Morrow family are reunited in North Queensland. Hello, I'm Kate Banville. I've caught up with these descendants of Luigia and Francesco Morrow on what would have been Luigia's 123rd birthday. The family has gathered here in tropical Townsville, a world away from where Luigia started her life in the snow-capped mountains of northern Italy. Let me introduce you to Pauline Villelli. She has spent years researching the family's history, documenting the couple's journey to Australia 100 years ago and the life they built in their new home.
Francesco Morrow and Luigia Di Razzi, who arrived on the Moncalieri 100 years ago, were my grandparents, my Italian grandparents. They came from the north of Italy, where, you know, they would have worn coats and boots in the snow and in the cold. My grandfather apparently used to go to Verona for the opera, and it's very hard to imagine. I did read in the newspaper that only the week before they arrived, Townsville got electric lights in the main street in Flinders Street. Before that, it was gaslight.
Like so many post-First World War European migrants, the pair set sail in hopes of a new life and arrived in Australia at the Townsville port on June 4, 1922. A report in the Townsville Daily Bulletin, published on June 6, 1922, described the atmosphere. Down at the concrete pier on Sunday morning, any man might have been excused for believing that he was in sunny Italy instead of sunny Queensland, for far more Italian than English was being spoken. That's an excerpt from the article which painted a picture of excitement of what was the unknown for all aboard. It went on to say, the explanation was the somewhat unexpected arrival of the Italian steamer with 273 passengers for Australia, of whom 226 proposed going to the sugar districts of the north and consequently landed at Townsville. But nothing was known for certain until the big steamer appeared round the point of Magnetic Island on Saturday afternoon and anchored in the bay. Francesco and Luigia were both on board the ship, but it would be months later before they met further north. Lured by the prospect of a new life, the migration scheme that brought them here was aimed at filling labour shortages in Australia's growing industry. It saw thousands of men cutting cane by hand in the steamy plantations of North Queensland. Luigia found work near Innisfail as a cook for cane cutting gangs, of which Francesco was a member. They married on December 30, 1923 at South Johnston, where they later bought land and established a cane farm. The couple went on to have four children, Angelo, Rina, Jobata, or John as he was known, and Goristo, or Gary as he is known.
Quite obviously it's not like it is today. They had never had modern tools and that sort of thing, and everything had to be done by hand sort of thing, which both my parents, mother and father, worked so hard. My mother was a great cook. She'd make a spaghetti sort of thing and have it drying, hanging it up all around the what's-his-name. And her favourite way of measuring things, she'd pour whatever it was into the palm of her hand and dip it into the pot.
Luigia and Francesco were building a new life in Australia, but it wasn't easy, and at times it was lonely. They eventually lost touch with their family in Italy. At first, they relied on sending handwritten letters by ship to maintain communication, and Francesco, wanting to care for them, would tuck Australian pound notes in the paper.
It was very difficult during the Second World War for them to keep contact in Italy because, according to the family stories, letters would arrive from Italy and they would have whole lines cut out. And we did lose contact then after that time, I think, and was only really renewed with the inheritance in 1986.
Enacting that family estate sparked the journey Pauline has been on, retracing the Moro family history. 6 months ago, her research took her to the National Archives in Brisbane, where she uncovered her nonna's original passport. Unbeknownst to them, it was surrendered on arrival in Townsville to customs officers. It's the only physical item the family has of Luigia's journey to Australia. Sharing these memories as a family has been the best part for Pauline.
Yeah, to have what I have down and to be able to present it and, to have the support, particularly of my cousins, who are also very interested in it. I knew our grandmother. She lived with me and my family until she passed away. And so, it's been rewarding to share it.
Members of the extended Moreau family who are catching up in Townsville in North Queensland and remembering their Italian grandparents. You can read more on that story from reporter Kate Banville. Head online to the RN homepage and look for A Big Country under the Programs tab. My name's Clint Jasper, with you for A Big Country this week. And still to come, we'll hear about a record-breaking attempt to make the biggest ever tea cozy. And a gap year with a difference. We'll meet a teen who's spending her post-high school year taking on an outback adventure.
Leroy is our little bay gelding. We actually bought him up at Mount Louis near Cooktown. He's been really good so far. He's our pack horse, one of our pack horses. He's quite hardy. He doesn't get injured or anything very easily. He's proven to be really good. He's a little bit nosy into your bags and trying to look for food. But yeah, he's a very friendly horse.
Libby Wiley just turned 18, and along with Leroy and three other trusted horses, she is embarking on the adventure of a lifetime. She's aiming to complete the National Bicentennial Trail, travelling from the country's north to the south on horseback. The Bicentennial Trail follows old coach roads, stock routes, bumpy tracks, rivers and fire trails from Cooktown in far north Queensland all the way down to Healesville in Victoria. All up, it covers more than 5,000 kilometres and will take Libby more than 1 year to travel.
We have four horses. That's two pack horses, two riding horses. A lot of the time we get off and walk, give the horses a break. We do about 20 k's a day on the horses.
Hello, I'm Phil Prantell. I caught up with Libby at Machuba on the Atherton Tablelands, about 100 kilometres inland from Cairns in far north Queensland, where she is having a couple of well-earned rest days. Libby is just 3 weeks into her epic voyage and says she's already learnt some valuable lessons.
Well, I've learnt that it's definitely not easy. It can be very mentally challenging as well as physically. There's long periods of time where you may not see people. It helps with your connection with the horses. Like, you really learn about your full-time living with them. So you really learn, you know, get a connection with them. And
you're going to be in a lot of very remote areas. Talk to me about, you know, taking food and water and communications and things like that.
Well, most of the time we have no service. For powering our phones, we carry little solar panel charging things to strap on the back of the horses when it's sunny. Food-wise, we pack dry, dehydrated foods, nuts, little packet soups and little pasta, things like that. Rice, 2-minute noodles. Water, we drink creek water, dam water. We carry little purification tablets. Doesn't make it taste any better, but definitely clears the bacteria and everything. But yeah, definitely appreciate clean water when we get it.
Rob Wiley is travelling with his daughter for the first few weeks after initially attempting the Bicentennial Trail in 1997.
Yeah, so I first met my wife. She came to Australia with the dream of doing the National Trail. We met and we fell in love, and I said I'd do it with her. So that was the start of our relationship, and 25 years later, here we are.
Why are you doing it again?
Well, I thought my horse riding days were over, but I wanted to be a part of this with Libby, just to get her on her way, help her, teach her a few skills, maybe impart a little bit of my knowledge. Just think it's a great thing to be able to do.
How challenging has it been spending day in, day out with your daughter in remote areas on horseback?
It's challenging. We get on really well, and I think it's been great. There are a few times when we're deciding which way we're going to go. Someone has to make a decision. But look, it's fantastic. I've really enjoyed it, so it's been a pleasure.
This could take 12, even longer, 18 months to complete this. What are you hoping to achieve or get out of it?
I won't be doing the whole trip with Libby. I've got to go back to work, unfortunately. I just hope to get Libby going on her way. Hopefully we can I'll join her in other parts of the trail, that's for sure. But yeah, I won't be going all the way to Victoria.
The Bicentennial Trail travels through some of the most remote parts of Western Queensland and New South Wales, meaning that phone and internet navigation is non-existent.
We're using a compass, a little paper map, and we have a few apps on our phone, but they generally don't work when you're not in service, so it's very easy to get lost, especially when you're trying to follow tracks that are barely a track anymore. And some parts are really well marked, others aren't so consistent. So it's a lot of backtracking, you know, following that track, coming back, and a lot of extra K's, especially when you get lost. It can get...
Hang on, let's talk about that. Have you been lost?
We've been lost plenty of times in the last week or so. At one point, we just had to follow the river. We followed, we worked out the exact bend of the river where the trail goes through, and we were bushed in the middle of nowhere. So we just bush-bashed our way to the river, and we followed it, and we eventually bumped into a dirt road where the trail picked up and found our way from there. But yeah, it's definitely a good adventure, and you appreciate it when you get somewhere. You know, you see a house and you get really excited, or a person. It definitely makes you appreciate everyday things.
No mobile phones, no telecommunications, no TV. You may not see a person for days. What is that isolation like?
It's quite stressful sometimes, you know, like it's very different to what I'm used to, you know, like seeing people every day with my family just in my house, whereas now it's a lot of independence as well. Like, we have to find our own way, just us, no technology. You can get quite anxious at times.
Are you running on time? Is there a timetable or anything like that?
Not really. Just as much as the horses need a break, we like to give them breaks. If the horses are still feeling willing, you know, they're still in good spirits, we keep going, we press on. It's all about the horses, really, so there's too many variables to have an exact timetable. You really just need to go and do what you can.
Okay, so jug is on, and I thought this morning we might have a little go at not using tea leaves, but using tea bags, and having some nice tea, a morning tea bag, with some old plates that came from Mum, which one of them is from the Queen's coronation, and some other lovely tea sets, pieces that are there, and the good cut glass.
Well, it's always a pleasure to come and sit down to a traditional cup of tea and morning tea with you and have a catch-up about what's happening with your tea cozies.
Indeed, indeed. Could I ever have predicted what was going to happen?
Who would have thought where tea cozies would take you?
Well, it's taken me halfway round the east coast of Australia.
Hello, I'm Emma Siossian. I'm enjoying a cuppa with Robin Lauder at her home surrounded by mountains and bushland at Upper Lansdowne near the town of Taree on the New South Wales mid-north coast. It's a relaxing, creative space where Robin, a retired science teacher, spends plenty of time creating knitted tea cosies. She has a long history as something of a tea cosy expert. When she was a child, she helped her mother knit tea cosies for sale at large Sydney department stores. Last year, Robin and her tea cosies featured in an ABC Mid-North Coast story, and it led to her being discovered by those in charge of a large community event in Victoria's South Gippsland, the Fish Creek Tea Cosy Festival. They invited Robin to be the judge at this year's festival, and Robin says the experience has enriched her life.
And it reinforced my faith that craft has not been lost. People used all sorts of techniques. Some used pottery, some used the little mosaic. They have another category called exuberant whimsy, and that's where you get these unbelievably creative ideas. There were all sorts of fibres. So it's not a dying art. I was a little bit concerned that that might be a dying art, but seeing the broad range and where the stuff has come from, it came from all over Australia, there was some stuff from New Zealand. It was, and then they had the biggest tea cosy challenge.
Yes, now I saw the photo of that, this giant tea cosy standing more than 5 metres tall.
Exactly. It's about 20-odd metres in circumference and it was 5.11 metres tall, so it outstripped the one that had been the winner with Guinness Book of Records some years ago. But the really interesting thing about that is it was a community effort, and when it was dismantled the morning after, they'd had the measurement because they had, you know, specialist people to come and do the measurement, and they were filling out paper forms for the Guinness Book of Records, was that they most of them had been just stitched together with fishing lines. So they were going to remove the fishing line, and then the majority of them, from what I understand, were going up to the flood victims in Lismore.
You've been involved in knitting tea cosies from when you were a child. Where did it begin for you?
Oh, it began when I had a bit of a knee problem, and being a very active kid, the doctor said to Mum and Dad, I think you better find something to occupy or she'll drive you nuts. And so Mum had already supplemented our income with making tea cosies for the department stores in Sydney and little craft shops and gift shops around the local area. And so I got into that and I got a bit addicted to it. And it was one of the things that helped me earn some pocket money while I was incapacitated, I suppose you could say. And then when I got working, I couldn't do as much because I was busy working. And then as I got closer to retirement, I thought, what am I going to do? And I thought, oh, I've always had this passion. I love my crochet. I love my knitting. And people are sort of taking on more interest in things and think, oh, well, you're not just a science teacher. You know, you think science teachers are sort of nerdy and don't have any other interests. But
You're a creative scientist.
Well, I am a creative scientist. That's using the right side of my brain instead of the left. And it's just been really, really good. I've met lots of interesting people. These are the ones I remember as a kid. Mum used to sell stacks of these. You know, it was just amazing. And, of course, she made herself this one. It's got a red tile roof, and it's got a front door that says come in with a little cottage garden and a couple of windows.
Must be some nice memories tied up looking at these tea cosies.
There are. And what amazes me is that they're still in really, really good condition.
How old would that be?
Oh, how old am I? I'd say they'd have to be about 60, 65 years old at least.
Well, I think it might be time we put your tea cosy here to use and had some tea.
It sounds good to me. This is the tea cosy style that I've taken to. It's like a basket weave main part, and then on the top I knit little coloured flowers and arrange them on the top of the teapot to keep the tea extra warm. There we go. And away you go with the milk. There we go. I might have a bit of sugar this time.
Robin Lauder is an expert on tea cosies, and she spoke to reporter Emma Siosian from her home on the New South Wales mid-north coast. And I just love how excited Robin was about tea cosies and everywhere that passion has taken her. You can see more on that story, including photos of the world record-setting giant tea cosy, as well as all of the stories you've heard on today's program. Just jump online to the RN homepage, where you'll find a big country under the programs tab. That is the show for today. I'll be back with you next week with more stories from the regions. I'll talk to you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.